Act and a Soup to Nuts production company, Universal churned out shows like A Ford Assembly Line. As the FCC barred networks from producing their own content, a rule that wasn't fully eliminated until 1995, NBC was dependent on Lou Wasserman's largesse. Our WMA contingent stayed at the Sherry Netherland on Fifth Avenue, where all of Los Angeles gathered for the week. After flogging our pilots hard for days, on the night before the schedule was announced, we'd see Lou Wasserman stride through the lobby to head to his suite. A few minutes later, NBC's vice president for programming would be ushered into the elevator and up to Lou's rooms. It was pretty obvious from the schedules announced the next day what happened up there. NBC, we need a detective drama for Wednesday night. Lou, we'll get you Peter Falk in a wheel with Dennis Weaver and Rock Hudson. And that would become the NBC mystery movie, a rotation of Columbo, McLeod, and McMillan and Wife. Or Lou might say, we'll give you a family show with Robert Young as a doctor who cares about his patients' lives. And presto, Marcus Welby, M.D. Whether it was a Thursday night comedy or a weekend western, Lou had what they wanted, or what he told them they wanted. He set the menu, and they ate the food. After NBC stuffed itself with Universal's programs, the rest of us fought over the remaining slots. As strong as WMA was, we were a pale shadow of the way MCA had dominated agenting in the 50s, or the way Universal ran television now. You could not beat Lou Wasserman. Chapter 4. Good Cop, Bad Cop. Not long after I made agent, Ron Meyer came to William Morris from the Paul Kohner Agency and was assigned to TV talent. He was 25, 2 years older than me, and the first thing that struck me was how nice he seemed, how skilled at putting people at ease. Gravel-voiced and sleepy-eyed, Ron was a high school dropout who'd served a hitch in the military. He had a Marine Corps tattoo on his arm, and who presented himself as a self-taught, well-read street fighter. He was terrific at his job, but felt a little insecure at a place where a college education had become the norm. He reminded me a lot of my dad, a friendly street guy with savoir-faire. But Ron was smarter than my dad, and shrewder. We hit it off right away. Two kids with no money who resented the guys with rich parents and fancy cars. I drove a 65 Mustang, while Ron had an aging Porsche two-seater that barely ran. Something about being around Ron made me completely comfortable. I felt happy with him, at home. I admired Ron because he had what I didn't, a relaxed charm, an ability to do things for people he hated with a warm, lazy smile. Judy and I began to hang out with him and his wife, Dolly Colton, and their friends. Ron was a neat freak who liked the occasional home-cooked meal. Dolly was a gregarious redhead born to wealth who had no interest in the domestic arts. Friction was inevitable, and soon Ron wanted a divorce. He couldn't afford a lawyer, so I helped him choreograph an exit with Dolly and her formidable father. We agreed that he needed to be aggressive, like an agent. He'd open by asking them for alimony. After all, they had the money. Dolly and her father settled for a clean split of the couple's assets. Single once more, Ron unleashed his ample charisma. One day we saw Genevieve Bujold idling her Mercedes convertible in the office parking lot. Ron was obsessed with Genevieve, a Morris client and a very hot actress at the time. Now she was 20 feet away. Ron looked at me, then walked over to introduce himself as one of her agents. He told her how great she was and said he'd love to get to know her better. Then he asked if he could buy her an ice cream cone someday. I saw Genevieve nod and smile. They had a date! Ron's invite was so innocuous, it worked. It wasn't a drink or a nighttime proposition. It was an ice cream cone. That was Ron Meyer. Phil Weltman cut a wide swath at William Morris. He ran the training program and cycled younger agents through the departments. In effect, he decided our destinies. Square-jawed and no-nonsense, Phil was a born drill sergeant. One morning, he summoned a guy named Jimmy Goldsmith. Jimmy had shoulder-length hair, as was increasingly common in the early 1970s, and Phil lectured him on the virtues of a good haircut. When Phil called him in again at 5 p.m. and saw that Jimmy hadn't made it to the barber, he fired him. But we revered Phil, the one senior executive who valued both loyalty and initiative. While he vocally promoted the William Morris values, Phil called out the ugly stuff, too. such as the old guard's resistance to teamwork and promoting younger agents. We'd later make Phil's philosophy a central tenet of CAA, but it went against the grain at William Morris, where it was every man for himself. Under Phil's tutelage, Ron and I decided to sign clients as a twosome, ideally clients who worked in prime time. We met a talented TV writer named Norman Lear, whose sitcom pilot about a working-class family in Queens had just been picked up by CBS. The new guy there, Fred Silverman, was ditching rural-themed shows like Green Acres for urban contemporary programming. All in the Family debuted in 1971 and topped the Nielsen ratings 5 years running. The show's leads, Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton, already had agents, but Sally Struthers and Rob Reiner were relative unknowns, and Norman introduced them to us. When we visited the set, I wore my navy suit and Ron wore jeans and a pullover. We promised to find Sally, who wanted a more rounded career, TV movies and theater jobs whenever All in the Family went on hiatus. She liked the idea of two agents for the price of one, and by the second meeting, she was ours. Rob had written for the Smothers Brothers, but was straining to get his own material off the ground. We snagged him a job directing a TV movie called Sunny Boy, the beginning of Rob's distinguished run as a director and producer, and signed him and his wife, Penny Marshall, who later became the star of Laverne and Shirley. Norman Lear had a genius for making hit shows. Over the next few years, he put 11 more sitcoms on the air, including Maude and The Jeffersons. Ron and I dogged his cast members, signing John Amos from Good Times and Damond Wilson from Sanford and Son. We made a great team because we had a great rap. I was formal, reserved, analytical, and concise, and Ron was sociable, sympathetic, disarming, and loose. You needed a persona as an agent, something that made you unique. I'd heard that Sam Cohn, the famously rumpled New York agent, cut holes in his sweaters to make them look moth-eaten. Sam's persona was the absent-minded genius. Ron's was the best friend and confidant, the I'll-fix-all-your-problems guy. I had given a lot of thought to my persona. There were three options. Number one was standard agent, the schmoozer, the glad-hander, but I didn't want to be standard in any way. Number two was Leland Hayward, an absolute gent who had his own agency in the 40s and handled such clients as Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, Jimmy Stewart, and Judy Garland. Leland was legendary for his consideration. If a client wanted to leave, Leland would let her go without a word of protest or a hint of rancor. Everyone loved him. That was incredibly appealing, but I sensed that Leland's persona wasn't the right fit for me. Believe it or not, in those days I was affable and considerate, with never a bad word about anyone, but you need to pick a persona you can inhabit without strain, and I knew I'd do better as the opposite of Ron, as the all-business tough guy who'd protect you. I could see that's what the biggest stars and directors wanted. So my persona became the I'll-make-your-dreams-come-true guy mixed with the I'll-fix-your-problems guy. Ron was the good cop, and I was the bad. Ronnie and Mike. I actually always hated the lunch pail nickname Mike and spent countless hours reminding everyone, my friends call me Michael. But Mike stuck to me like a burr. Underneath the roles, though, Ron and I were always more alike than even our colleagues realized. Ron's easygoing demeanor hid a personality as calculating and determined and tightly wound as mine was. Our bosses periodically gathered us to trumpet the latest signings and whip up the troops. I usually sat in the back with Ron and the other young agents. We weren't supposed to speak at these rallies, just listen. In the fall of 1974, CMA stole Steve McQueen from us. At the next meeting, Sam Weisbord proudly announced that he'd roped in an equally big name, Ann Miller. A mutinous murmur arose. Miller had been a star in MGM musicals 20 years earlier. Ron spoke up suddenly to suggest that we go after some of CMA's biggest clients, some actual stars, to even the score. Sam Weisbord's eyes started to twitch like crazy, and he lost his mind, shouting, "You don't know what you're talking about! She's a star!" I completely agreed with Ron, but I would have discussed it with Sam in private, where his ego wouldn't have been on the line. Ron was extremely direct, not tactical. I left the meeting deflated. Ann Miller was doing dinner theater and earning a decent income, which was all Sam cared about, but we cared about the company's image. When people asked about new clients, we wanted to brag about a Jane Fonda or a Jacqueline Bisset, not some 51-year-old song and dance queen. Our feelings were ageist, sexist, lookist, and any number of other ists, but then, so is Hollywood. The Ann Miller meeting was like the first time you realize your parents are old. I'd played the rules at William Morris, and so far it had worked, but I began to ask, what if guys like Ron and me had more of a say? And then, what if we could run a company of our own? The Beverly Hills and New York offices of WMA were bitter rivals. Movies were handled in Los Angeles and theater in New York. Television was split, with sales on the East Coast and creative work and packaging in L.A., and the two camps were insanely jealous of each other. Late in 1974, we had a visit from Lou Weiss, one of the inner circle executives around Morris President Nat Lefkowitz in New York. He asked to meet with the agents in charge of TV packaging. Roland Perkins, who covered CBS, Mike Rosenfeld, who covered ABC, and Bill Haber, who handled NBC. I was present for my daytime work signing and packaging game show producers and directors. As a group, we killed it. Roland, Mike, and Bill accounted for 21 programs for primetime, and I had packaged 7 more in daytime, more pilots altogether than any other outfit in town, including major studios such as Universal. Lou breezed into Roland's office in a stunning suit and Gucci loafers. We were huddled in our not-so-dapper suits, waiting for our attaboy. We had a strong sales season on both coasts, Lou began, but we could do better. Roland Perkins, who'd counted on becoming the next West Coast head of television, bent forward as if he'd been gut-punched. Nat Lefkowitz would slide a New Yorker into the job instead. Happy-go-lucky Mike Rosenfeld looked like his dog had died. Bill Haber's left foot was tapping furiously. As Lou droned on, Bill's foot tapped faster and faster. After Lou left, everyone exploded. "That was unbelievable," Mike said. "It's horrible," cried Bill, dangerously flushed. In 1973, when I had brought in close to $2 million in commissions on a weekly salary of $400, William Morris had given me a $7,500 bonus. In 1974, the agency's leaders recognized my 7 pilots by upping my bonus to $15,000, which they thought handsome, given that all of us could do better. Meanwhile, every day we walked past the office of Joe Rifkin, a last Fogel crony who read the newspaper for hours with his feet up. There were 3 or 4 guys like that around, big wheels from way back when, who were just diluting our bonus checks. The only way they'd leave was feet first. It drove Ron nuts. Phil Weltman's downfall began when they made him an administrator, and he gave all but a few of his clients to younger agents. Though Phil and Sam Weisbord had been best friends, dating to their bachelor roommate days, they fell out after Sam got tight with Mr. Lastfogel. When Phil irked the bosses once too often, he had no rabbis left to protect him. It happened a few weeks before Christmas of 1974. Phil called Ron and me and a few of his other confidants into his office. Sam Weisbord had asked him to leave the company, he said. They put my name in the computer and it came up wanting. The man who made confident agents quake, who taught me the meaning of strength, that tough, tough man, broke down in front of us. That lit the fuse. At dinner one night, Ron said, "Why don't we go into business for ourselves? We'll make more money and they'll never be able to do to us what they did to Phil." Ron was persuasive, but I felt conflicted. Sam Weisbord, my rabbi, was next in line for the presidency, and Walt Zifkin, the agency's controller, had told me I'd run the place someday. Judy and I were the fair-haired couple at the company. I had more to gain by staying than Ron, and more to lose by leaving. Seeing me hesitate, Ron said, "You have no gamble in you. Sometimes you have to step up and roll the dice." That got me thinking. I was 27. If we busted in 3 years, I could land a new job and start over. But I wasn't about to gamble on a 2-man boutique. If we left William Morris, I wanted to build a giant agency and beat them at their own game. A few days later, Mike Rosenfeld confided to Ron that he and Roland and Bill were leaving. They wanted Ron to join them and handle the talent while they packaged network and studio deals. Ron urged them to add me as well, and they agreed. I was surprised by Ron's willingness to throw in with Bill, who was famous for torturing his staff with work-related trivia quizzes. He drove Ron crazy every day. Nonetheless, I went to the Rebels' first meeting, after work at a bar called the Golden Bull. We were an unlikely group, united more by opposition to WMA than by any plan for an alternative. Roland Perkins was the eldest, nearly 40, handsome, silver-haired, an agent out of central casting. But he was a salaryman at heart, comfortable with a guaranteed paycheck. Mike Rosenfeld was a fantastic agent, beloved by everyone, but he was obsessed with the idea that because his father had died young, he would too. So he was out every night, burning the candle before it was snuffed out. Bill Haber was brilliant, creative, and prickly. Later on, it became important to him to drive around in a Volkswagen Bug to be the "I'm not really an agent" agent. When CAA was running smoothly, he was always threatening to quit and go work with blind children. Ron led off with his idea for a Meyer-Ovitz or Ovitz-Meyer agency. The others quickly talked us out of it. Together, the five of us had the three major networks covered. We'd earned our stripes in talent and in packaging, the two main facets of TV agenting. I gave us a beachhead in day parts, which generated cash flow every week, much faster than the returns from primetime, a key consideration as none of us had much money to plow into the venture. I was making $45,000 a year, but I still owed William Morris $15,000 for the down payment on my house in Sherman Oaks in the Valley. Two clients were sure to follow us. Ron was very close to the character actor Jack Weston, and I thought of Kelly Lang, an L.A. news anchor, as the sister I'd never had. We rated a dozen others, including Sally Struthers and Rob Reiner, as probables. With a bunch of iffies, we had a list of about 75 names. I weighed in on 3 points. It seemed to me that we should take advantage of the fact that we were young and aggressive. Ron, Bill, and I were all under 30, to try out new ideas that could reshape the ways the town did business. First, I said, the equity had to be split evenly. Second, we had to try to get as big as we could. Third, we'd share our clients and serve them as a group. No turf wars, no silos. At William Morris, we had many an agent who excelled at signing artists but stumbled in finding work for them. Wouldn't it be better, I said, if clients could rotate freely within our firm? We'd be five musketeers, one for all and all for one. Everyone would handle everyone, and everyone would tell our clients the truth. It was standard procedure in the agency business when a client called with unpleasant news or a dangerous rumor. I hear I'm getting fired off the film, to say, don't worry, I know all about it and it's fine, even if this was the first you'd heard of it. We would pioneer the calm, no bullshit approach, saying instead, let me look into it and I'll get right back to you. We'd be better agents because we wouldn't agent you. The other thing that would differentiate us, and it was a big one, was that we would create work for our clients, not just field offers. Everyone agreed. Suddenly, the revolt felt real. On the first Friday of 1975, I knocked off early to go skiing with Judy at Mammoth Mountain, 5 hours away. There were no cell phones or pagers in those days, and no one knew where we were. I needed to get away to think my future through before talking one more time with Ron. When we got back to our tract house Sunday evening, a note was taped to the front door. It was from Mike Rosenfeld. Call me before you talk to anybody. When I called, he said, I hope you could afford that ski trip because you're now unemployed with the rest of us. Before leaving town, I had applied for a credit line for our new agency at City National Bank. I listed the five partners' names on the forms. Unfortunately, the guy who ran City National was a friend of William Morris's CFO. The day I left town, Sam Weisbord had taken Roland for a walk and said, is it true? Are you leaving? Anyone else would deny it in a heartbeat. Anyone but Roland, the straightest arrow in Southern California. After he threw us all under the bus, Weisbord called in the co-conspirators one by one. We were officially fired that day, but Sam wanted to see me on Monday. For closure, I guess. You couldn't call Sam Weisbord personable, but he'd given me my first break and treated me with respect. Had he told me that he was hurt and that he wanted me to stay, there's a very good chance I'd have backed down and asked Ron to do the same. I felt no obligation to Bill and Mike and Roland. If Sam had played it smart, he might have broken up the whole thing before it started. Instead, he fixed me with an arrogant stare and said, "You've really screwed yourself this time." His bad eye was twitching up a storm. I said, "Look, it is what it is." I went to my office, packed up my Rolodex, and left the building for the last time. We'd counted on 3 more months to get organized, but our future was now. We held an emergency meeting at Roland's house in Upper Bel Air. As a former WMA vice president, he was the logical choice to run the show, but that night he hardly said a word. Having just lost an annual paycheck of at least $250,000, he was clearly in shock. I had made a checklist of everything we needed to do. Find an office, get stationery, get a license, come up with a logo, and so on. I was the most junior of the group, an afterthought, but as I moved down my to-do list, nobody else was chiming in. Ron was superb at managing in the moment, but indifferent to administration. Bill Haber had a counterpuncher style. Mike Rosenfeld had no desire for added responsibility. So I kept talking, and I never stopped. Through our first few weeks in business, jobs kept falling into my lap. We all liked the name Artist Agency because it denoted a client-centered culture, but another agency had previously used it. So I proposed adding creative to suggest both our clients' creativity and our own. Mike and I sketched the CAA logo, and I ordered stationery. David Wolper, the William Morris client who produced Chico and the Man, gave us temporary office space, a room on La Cienega with 2 phones. WMA pressured him to throw us out, a hint of things to come. 2 weeks later, we scraped together $100,000 by putting up our homes as collateral. Ron and I paid a deposit on a bargain bin lease in a lower-end building on Doheny and Wilshire at the very edge of Beverly Hills. The former tenant, the landlord said, had been a wig maker. CAA was a prototypical startup. We brought in folding chairs and card tables for desks, and our wives each came in 1 day a week to answer the phones. We had 1 paid assistant, a bookkeeper, and 2 cars among the 5 of us. The Screen Actors Guild sent someone out to make sure we were for real. The guy came back a second time after the wig maker turned out to have been an escort service. To launch with a statement, we had slashed our packaging commission from 10% to 6. It was a go-for-the-throat move to undercut William Morris and the rest, and it sounded like more of a bargain than it was. We'd still take 10% on the back end in syndication, where the real money was. But we quickly realized that no one was knocking the door down to take advantage of our cut-rate commission, or for any other reason. Our first big problem was that Jack Weston and Kelly Lang wound up staying at WMA. The agency's Norman Brokaw convinced Kelly that he was going to make her a giant personality. We'd have done the same thing in his place. We did do it many times later. But it was a devastating blow. The other clients we had wouldn't bring in enough to support us. For years, we used the story of Jack Weston and Kelly Lang not following us, after they'd sworn up and down that they would, to teach our young agents. Don't ever think that what is, because it isn't. Never count on anybody or anything. Our second big problem arrived by messenger a few weeks in, an envelope addressed to me from Leon Kaplan of Kaplan, Livingston, Goodwin, Berkowitz, and Selvin, the mammoth law firm that represented Warner Brothers and 20th Century Fox, and almost everyone who was anyone in the entertainment business. Their letterhead listed 72 attorneys and made it feel like a whole country was declaring war on you. Kaplan informed me that his client, Freddie Fields, controlled the rights to both Artists Agency and Creative Management Associates, Freddie's previous firms. We were therefore infringing by using Creative Artists Agency and must immediately cease and desist. I reread the letter. I was puzzled about why he'd singled me out rather than writing to the partnership, but I figured I'd have to devise our response. I knew Sam Weisbord and Leon Kaplan were close and that Kaplan's firm had represented the Morris Agency forever. I also knew that Kaplan did not represent CMA, and I knew that Freddie Fields had recently cashed out of CMA to become a movie producer and a client of Kaplan's. I connected the dots. Alarmed by our package fee discount, William Morris had deputized Fields to harass us into relinquishing our name and starting over, a mortal blow to an infant company. This was serious trouble. If we slugged it out in court, the fees would suck us under fast. Ron and I had just run into a young WMA agent at a party. "You know what the betting is back at the office," he said, "that you'll be out of business in 6 months and working as casting agents." My one play, a long shot, was to intimidate my old boss. From working for Sam, I knew the Department of Justice was probing William Morris for monopolistic practices in their TV work, the conflicts of interest that we lived with daily. The rumor was that Lou Wasserman had tipped off the department because he was annoyed at having to pay WMA's package commissions. Nothing was likely to come of it, but the agency's leaders remained apprehensive. I told my partners my plan, and very anxiously, they finally agreed. They thought it was a lousy idea, but no one had a better one. I drained a glass of water and cleared my throat. I needed to believe in what I was about to say, and my voice absolutely could not crack. I rang Leon Kaplan. He sounded arrogant, and why not? He pegged CAA as weak, broke, and defenseless. "Mr. Kaplan," I said, "we haven't met, but I know who you represent. I think you're trying to put us out of business. I think it's inappropriate and unfair, and it could be really interesting if this went to the Justice Department in the middle of their antitrust investigation." My tone was firm, but matter of fact. I went on, "You can rip up this letter and we can all be friends and forget about it, or you can pursue it, and I will call a pal of mine who happens to work at Justice, and I'll ask him to throw this into the hopper, and we'll see how it all sorts out." Dead silence. Then Kaplan said, "What are you suggesting?" "I'm suggesting you send me a handwritten letter within the next 2 hours, withdrawing the first letter, or tomorrow morning I'll call my friend." Then I thanked him and hung up. I gave no thought to the repercussions or to the fact that I was bluffing, because we'd be out of business before the feds could get around to dealing with the call I'd never make anyway to a friend I didn't have. I played my hand as calmly as I could and waited for the outcome. Only after I'd hung up did I realize my hands were shaking. Time crawled by. 15 minutes before the deadline, a messenger arrived with a new letter from Kaplan. In the space of an afternoon, he moved from cease and desist to cease fire. That day forged our siege mentality. To defend our tiny position, we unleashed hell on anyone who crossed us. For starters, we refused to take on any client who used Kaplan Livingston, and within 5 years the firm was defunct. I'm not saying we did them in, but we did help nudge them toward the edge. Our counterassault on William Morris took longer to deploy, but proved nearly as effective. And a few years later, when Jack Weston told a friend of Ron's that he wanted to come to CAA, Ron replied, "Tell him he can go fuck himself. Not if he was the last client on Earth." One of the strongest bonds Ron and I shared was a belief that any betrayal must be avenged. For the rest of my time at CAA, I was a great friend and ally, but an implacable foe. When you're 28 years old and you've quit your job and there's no going back, and then the industry leader tries to smother your baby in its cradle, you steal up pretty fast. Kaplan's letter taught us to play hardball, and hardball we would play for the next 20 years. Chapter 5. From 0 to 1 million. Needing clients fast to pay our rent, we focused on TV writers and actors, two reliable sources of income. In TV, the talent got paid every Thursday, so the agents did too. For 6 months, we met with prospects by the hour, from 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, when we'd collapse with a delivery pizza. It was close to midnight on a grueling Friday when we got a call from the actor Jack Cassidy, one of our first new clients. He was a heavy drinker who had once startled his neighbors by watering his lawn naked. Clearly blitzed, Jack started in like it was a normal business hour. We rolled with it, having lost all normal frame of reference. Every waking hour was a working hour. Our top client was Chad Everett, who played Dr. Joe Gannon in CBS's long-running Medical Center. When a TV movie script came in with a $100,000 offer for Chad, it was a godsend. The $10,000 commission would float us for another month, but after we all read the script and assembled to call Chad, we did everything together then. To showcase our esprit de corps, there were 5 long faces around the conference table. The movie was crap. Chad was Bill Haber's contact, and Bill led off on speakerphone to warn against the project, but we all chimed in, unanimously recommending a pass. It would have been easy to tell Chad to take his $90,000 and run. No one would have slammed us for putting him in a bad TV movie, but we killed the offer without a second thought, and that moment established our business bona fides. We were not going to be flesh peddlers. We would put our clients' long-term interests first. We were able to stick to our ethical guns in part because I had sold a pair of game shows, Give and Take and Rhyme and Reason. Judy worked as a model on Give and Take and another game show, and she booked jobs at Bullock's department store and worked in the lounge at Pacific Southwest Airlines. For a while, she was paying all our bills. That fall, NBC took The Rich Little Show, our first primetime package. I still have the telex they sent to let us know. Buyers liked new agencies. The more sellers undercutting one another, the more leverage for them. In those days, buyers ran roughshod. If one agent balked at a studio's terms, there was always another, more desperate agency that represented a client who'd serve equally well. Our goal, which seemed amazingly distant, was to flip the power equation by amassing so much talent, the buyers couldn't go around us. After 9 months, we had 135 clients, and most of them had their best years in front of them. Ann Archer, Larry Hagman, or behind them, Hope Lang, Toadie Fields. We didn't have expense accounts. We paid for everything ourselves and deducted it from our individual taxes. Early on, Roland arranged a dinner for a couple of hot writers, Joe Bologna and Renee Taylor, at a fancy restaurant in Century City. We really wanted them, and we really wanted to show how all for one we were, so we brought our wives. Knowing that dinner for 12 was going to cost a fortune, we nervously reminded each other, they picked the place, so let's hope they pick up the check. Don't reach for it. As Joe was a regular there, we hoped the waiter would bring it to him. He did, but Joe just ignored it, puffing a big cigar. The check sat there glowing ominously. Finally, Roland's wife, Diane, took it and gave it to Roland. We were all horrified. I think that was the beginning of the end of their marriage. Roland slipped the check to Mike under the table, but he didn't have a credit card either. I was the only one who did, so I picked it up. $2,000 that we didn't have. Joe and Renee did sign with us without ever having any idea how close they came to putting us out of business. Broke as we were, we had to fake it till we could make it. At the Scala, a Beverly Hills bistro that was the place to be seen, I showed Tony, the maitre d', $100 bill. Then I ripped it in two and gave him half. My wife and I will be in for dinner tonight, I said, and I want you to give us the first booth on the right and treat us really, really well. If you do that, you'll get the other half of this bill and many more to come. $100 bought some remarkable service in 1975, and CAA went on to do many big business dinners at La Scala. We tipped lavishly and were hailed like the second coming of Daryl Zanuck. Then I took out a car loan and bought 5 Jaguars for $15,000 a pop, but only $1,500 each down. We ordered CAA license plates followed by a hyphen and the partner's initials. The cars were a rank extravagance for a company that would file zeros on its tax returns its first 3 years, but in a city of fantasy, a big show was essential. Though we had started to make a small mark in television, we had trouble persuading film stars to take us seriously. Sue Mengers, the biggest movie agent in town, mocked us as the TV boys. She was being mean, but she was right. That was all we had. I'm still stung by the memory of a lunch Mike and I had at the smokehouse with Tom Mount, the baby mogul who became president of Universal Pictures at 28. He was the Irving Thalberg of our time, albeit briefly. We needed the anointment of his recognition, and we talked a great game. Then Tom asked to see our client list. I didn't want to show it to him because it began and ended with Ernest Borgnine in film and Chad Everett in television. He insisted. As he looked at it with amused disappointment, I nodded at Mike, and we left without eating. I hated being pigeonholed as inferior. We all took a meeting with Jacqueline Bisset at her house, and my partners gave the agenting 101 pitch. You're a great actress. You should be doing more. You should have bigger roles, Oscar-winning roles. New agencies sell their youth and energy. I'll kill for you, because that's all they have. Seeing her skeptical expression, I jumped in and said, take off your actress hat for a moment and pretend that you're a small corporation. You're now JB Inc., and your revenue is X million a year. What can you do to increase your bottom line and control the direction of your future growth? You need to take control of your projects. Get involved in developing them. I believe that nobody wants to be treated as just what they are. Everyone wants to feel encouraged to become even more than they are, to become the best version of themselves. Afterward, in the car heading down the hill, we quarreled. Mike said, you can't look at her like she's a corporation. She's an actress. I said, I don't agree. We have to differentiate ourselves from the other agencies, and this is a great way to do it. Bissett's lawyer called and said she wanted another meeting, only just with me. I met with her again, but she decided to go with another agency. That was okay. As we got bigger, she got smaller. Mike was very close to Rick Ray of Adams, Ray & Rosenberg, a prestigious television literary agency that represented 400 writers. A year or so after CAA opened, Rick proposed that we join forces. The two firms met in our cramped conference room to seal the deal. Together, Lee Rosenberg declared, we'd be the best television agency in the business, even if we never represent movie stars like Robert Redford. Ron and I traded glances. I plan on representing movie stars, Ron said. Lee said, you'll never get them. They're locked up by the big boys. We're going to represent all of them, I said. I suddenly knew we were going to try to get as near to the whole market as it was possible to get to crush all comers. Our plan had been to wait 5 years before branching out to movies, but I was never good at waiting. Ron looked at me and nodded. I stood up, and then Ron stood up, and then Bill stood up, and the meeting and the merger were over. Mike was crushed. He was really close to Rick and had dreamed of working with him. That was the moment we realized Mike might not be with us for the long haul. I looked at Ron and Bill and said, we've got our whole lives ahead of us. We'll get the stars. I was 29, Ron 31, Bill 33. The Jacqueline Bissett meeting convinced me that the way forward was to sell our clients on our reach. We'd give them more info than anybody. They'd see every script and even get hot books and manuscript, preferential treatment befitting the CEO of his or her own corporation. We'd break into film by taking books and scripts and treatments to prospective clients. We'd bring the mountain to Muhammad. When New York Magazine touted Mort Janklow as the hottest literary agent, I rang him up. It took me 10 days to get him on the phone to ask if I could come see him. I flew to New York at a cost that made my stomach twitch. Mort's Midtown Manhattan office was done in Charles Gwathmey modernism, all angles and curves and rich oak paneling. Trying not to seem overawed, I laid out our book-first strategy. I asked to call him every Thursday at 10 a.m. in case he had something for us. Mort could have set his watch by my calls. I kept at it for a year, every week, no matter where I was, before he gave us a novel called Chiefs, a police drama set in the South. The story was solid, but Mort neglected to tell us that the networks had already turned it down. Bill Haber worked round the clock to get Chiefs produced and prove we were for real. His friend and client Martin Manulis, the producer of Gunsmoke, somehow wrangled Charlton Heston, a big enough star to get Chiefs adapted into a successful miniseries on CBS. Ecstatic, Mort started sending us manuscripts by his most commercial writers, Jackie Collins, Judith Krantz, Daniel Steele. We went on to package pulp sensations like Mistral's Daughter and Hollywood Wives, each of which brought the agency $50,000 to $100,000 up front and millions in syndication when they were resold to the nation's more than 600 independent stations. Scores of independent lit agencies needed a liaison to Hollywood buyers, and once Janklow began to vouch for us, CAA rapidly became that liaison. We threw parties at Elaine's, the watering hole on New York's East Side, frequented by Truman Capote, Woody Allen, Norman Mailer, and scores of agents, and won a lot of business. We offered a unique and attractive proposition. On any production that derived from the lit agent's source material, they'd keep their full commissions on the writer's fees. CAA would get paid by attaching actors and directors to the package. Soon, we had 80 agents sending us novels and manuscript to be optioned by our producers and then lateraled to our screenwriters for adaptation. After copying the scripts in bulk, we slapped on bright red covers with the white CAA logo and planted hundreds of them with scrawled notes and scuff marks for a used look in beauty parlors, restaurants, and doctor's offices. Most had no chance of selling, and we didn't leave any really important screenplays lying around, but they generated free publicity. They helped establish our brand in our race against larger but less agile firms like William Morris and International Creative Management, or ICM. We were making headway in our second year, but still barely breaking even. All I could think about was money, but Ron Meyer was the grasshopper to my aunt. He suddenly flew off to see Richard Chamberlain on a TV movie set in South Africa, an astronomical expense, especially when we needed Ron in L.A. We talked about it, not exactly in our indoor voices. I was the thrifty dad, and he was the spendthrift son. The subject recurred as we walked to our cars one Saturday. "Money is the scorecard of success," I said. "I don't get how it seems so unimportant to you." Ron said, "But money doesn't bring you happiness. My father was broke all his life, and he was the happiest guy you ever met." He took a quarter from his pocket and held it up. "See that?" "Yeah," I said. Ron flipped the quarter over a mesh-link fence onto the roof of a kiosk on the other side. I made a big show of scrambling to climb the fence to retrieve the quarter, and Ron laughed. We were both joking, but not really. That moment was us in a nutshell. Ron cared too little about money, and I cared too much. I never wanted fuck-you money, I wasn't greedy in that way, but I was hell-bent on making enough so I'd never have to go back to the valley. In 1977, after 2.5 years in which we'd netted nothing at all, each partner was able to take $80,000 out of our profits. For Roland, it was still less than a third of his William Morris salary, but at least the trend was in the right direction. Judy and I moved from Sherman Oaks to Brentwood, trading in our $75,000 house for one that cost $650,000. I'd wake up and think, "My God, I live in Brentwood." In late 1976, opportunity had come knocking in the unlikely form of a 52-year-old bon vivant named Marty Baum, an agent with his own shop and a beguiling line of blarney. He had a strong, if graying, list led by Peter Sellers, Rod Steiger, Carol O'Connor, Sidney Poitier, Julie Andrews, Blake Edwards, and Joanne Woodward. Marty felt lonely and wanted to join us. We debated for months. Would Marty's aging clients help or hurt our image? Could he share his list and adapt to our collective culture? We decided to make him a full 1/6 partner and never regretted it. He gave us a big foot in the door in films. His clients, whom he generously shared or outright handed over to the rest of us, made CAA a contender. And he made us all acquainted with haute cuisine. He didn't regret it either. In 5 years, he went from $100,000 a year to $500,000. Marty set me up with James Clavell, the best-selling author of King Rat and Taipan. Clavell's latest opus was Shogun, a sprawling historical novel about an English naval pilot shipwrecked in 17th-century Japan. The creator of these exotic tales led a simple life on Mulholland Drive. He rose each morning at 5:30, had coffee, took a walk, and was at his typewriter by 7 o'clock. He worked till noon when he went to lunch at Yamamoto's in Century City. We first met at Yamamoto's sushi bar, my initiation into eating raw fish. I liked the menu and the company so much that we met there several times a month for close to 20 years. James was a proper British gentleman, all double-breasted blue blazers and bone-dry humor. He was tall and imposing despite a limp that required him to use a cane, a memento of his time as a Japanese prisoner of war. After a few pieces of tuna sashimi, he asked me to read Shogun, which had bounced around town for years. The studios were always alarmed by its length, 1,200 pages. I packed the paperback on a weekend ski trip. At first, I struggled to keep the dozens of characters straight and to pierce the thicket of Japanese names, but by page 80, I was hooked. When Judy got annoyed that I was responding to her only with grunts, I ripped out the first chapter and passed it over. We spent a few hours on the slopes and the rest on the couch, literally tearing through Shogun. Marty and I talked the book up to the director Richard Dickey Attenborough, another Baum client, and then Dickey gave it to Robert Bolt, the screenwriter who wrote Lawrence of Arabia. We pitched the package of Attenborough and Bolt and Sean Connery and the book to Barry Diller and Michael Eisner at Paramount, who agreed to develop it. Dickey's theory was that Shogun could be squeezed into a 2.5-hour film by leaving some big chunks aside for sequels, but the book was just too big to generate a tidy script. Our package fell apart. Like most of America during the last week of January 1977, I had spent my evenings glued to Roots, the landmark miniseries about Black America. ABC aired it for 12 hours over 8 consecutive nights and garnered record ratings. 100 million viewers watched the finale, the largest television audience in history. It hit me, why couldn't we do the same with Shogun? James Clavell was horrified. He was a cinephile who'd written the screenplay for The Great Escape and directed 6 movies. "Television will ruin my book," he declared. Only a miniseries, I insisted, could do justice to Shogun's scope and sweep. With the author's extremely doubtful approval, Bill Haber and I went to Paramount to meet with Michael Eisner and Gary Nardino, who ran the studio's television division. Gary was eager to bring the project to the networks. We began at ABC, our best buyer, but they turned us down. CBS said the same thing. We don't think Americans care much about Asia. But Deanne Barclay, the head of TV movies at NBC, fell for James's novel and ordered 12 hours. Her faith was tested when the new writers adopted the perspective of John Blackthorne, the British sailor trapped in the East. To make Blackthorne's bewilderment hit home, they had the Japanese characters speak in Japanese without subtitles. It was avant-garde for prime time, but we backed the writers, and Deanne backed us. NBC budgeted Shogun at a lavish $22 million, which allowed it to be filmed in Japan and to therefore look and feel like an event. Paramount stepped up and agreed to deficit the project by funding any overage in the production costs. They expected to make their money back by selling syndication rights worldwide after NBC's first two runs of the series. We were on our way. Deanne and our agency disagreed just once over who should play Blackthorne. The network wanted Richard Chamberlain, best known as a teen heartthrob in the 60s medical show Dr. Kildare. I thought he was light for the role, but I was proved wrong. Richard's vulnerability made the character work. A virile, swashbuckling Blackthorne like Sean Connery wouldn't have been as sympathetic. Shogun's First Night, a three-hour installment in September 1980, told us we had a hit. Viewers loved the romance, the loyalties, and the betrayals, the Asian soap opera of it all, and they made it one of the highest-rated programs in NBC's history. It remains the second-most-watched miniseries after Roots. Shogun triggered a run of bestseller adaptations and helped set off the American craze for sushi. Never again would a network claim its viewers were indifferent to Asia. James was gratified by the show's fidelity to his novel. He liked it even better when more than 3 million Shogun paperbacks sold within a week of the last installment. He especially got a kick out of the bumper credits we'd negotiated. At each commercial break, the screen read, James Clavell's Shogun. When the show returned, viewers saw a second card. James Clavell's Shogun continues. It was one of our earliest efforts to brand our clients. A week after Shogun concluded, James called and asked to see me the next day. The usual place, I said. No, I want to meet at the McDonald's on Ventura Boulevard, off Van Nuys. What? He started laughing. Be there at 8:30 tomorrow morning. I walked into the McDonald's in one of my better blue suits and found myself underdressed. There was James at a booth in his blazer, ascot, and creased gray slacks, his cane at his side. Before him were two trays. Each held a cup of coffee and an Egg McMuffin. I sat down, and he handed over an envelope. I sliced it open and found a check with a dizzying number of zeros made out to Creative Artists Agency. James had persuaded Paramount to allow him to deliver our $1 million package commission. It was by far the biggest payday we'd ever had, nearly $3 million in today's money. Shogun had languished at William Morris for 3 years. CAA got it made. Never mind that the deal almost fell apart 20 times. Deals always almost fall apart 20 times. That was the first time we took a client's far-fetched dream and made it come true. In 1978, Andrea Eastman, an ICM agent I respected, told me, "You guys should be in the movie business. The way you work would be a breath of fresh air." Ron and I had been discussing that possibility, and Andrea's remark made us revisit the matter. But first, we wondered, why had she said that? Agents always had an agenda. There were no genuine compliments or candid suggestions. Was she trying to get us to stop focusing on TV, where we were starting to kill it? Was ICM planning a raid on our television talent? What was her nefarious plan? It turned out, astonishingly, that Andrea was just being honest and generous. Ron told me, "We should split this up. You do movies, and I'll straddle movies, doing film actors and TV." We were going after ICM, which had all the stars except those represented by Stan Kamen at WMA. In those days, the focus of representation was the social life. ICM's Sue Mengers would sign you, then invite you to the cocaine parties at her house in Beverly Hills. She'd also gossip about you. She called her stars sparklies to her other clients. We built our business as her opposite. We'd take tables in the back of restaurants, where we couldn't be overheard, lean in, and present ourselves as very square. You won't have a big social life with us, I'd say. We're here to make you independent in every direction, to strategize for you. So, what are your dreams? We didn't badmouth Sue, or anyone else, but the unspoken message of our presentation was, can any other agency deliver 10 people who've already had a pre-meeting about how to move your career ahead? Later on, before every meeting we took with our clients, I'd send a memo out to everyone in the company, even faintly or potentially involved in his or her work, trawling for ideas, and we always had a minimum of 5 people in the room. Hollywood was an archipelago of talent, thousands of separate islands, but directors and stars were the keystone islands. We needed to build bridges and connect the islands to make packages, which would turn us into a kind of studio. To get actors, we needed directors, because directors had the stars in their pockets. Sidney Pollack had Redford, and Martin Scorsese had De Niro. I wrote a list of the directors I wanted and thought I could conceivably get, many of them in comedy, which wasn't taken seriously in the agency world. Though Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau had made a fortune for WMA, agents there never treated them accordingly. My directors list included Steve Gordon, Albert Brooks, Ivan Reitman, Sidney Pollack, and, here I was dreaming, though the dream would eventually come to pass, Martin Scorsese and Stanley Kubrick. I was beginning to believe that I could converse with those guys, because when we launched CAA, I had started a private project, one that took me 10 years, of watching every film that had won one of the 5 big category Oscars. I discovered why Gone with the Wind had passed the test of time, and How Green Was My Valley hadn't. I learned the relationship between vision and craft. At the same time, I was boning up on the deal structure of movies and on which actors and directors had currency. Film had its own language, and I needed to be bilingual. But to get to the directors, there was a further step. We needed writers and their material. Directors wanted great material a lot more than they wanted to chat with me about the opening crane shot in Touch of Evil. The easiest way to make some headway through this obstacle course was to turn our television writers into movie writers and directors. I encouraged Barry Levinson to write a screenplay based on his youth in Baltimore, and he came up with Diner, his debut as a film director. The second easiest way was to turn other agencies' television writers into movie writers and directors. We wooed Steve Gordon, a TV writer with a screenplay about a millionaire alcoholic with a romantic dilemma. Steve's agents at ICM couldn't or wouldn't sell it. I sent the script to United Artists, which ordered the movie with Steve attached to direct. After Arthur became a surprise hit, Steve signed with us. We'd poach by assumption, behave as if we were the client's agent already, make their dream happen, and then they'd sign. Tragically, the following year, weeks after we had attached Steve to a comedy with Robert Redford, he had a fatal heart attack at 44. I was close to Steve, and his death stunned me. But I'm now astonished when I realize how quickly I put it behind me and got back to work building CAA. It took half a day. Don't look back. Someone was definitely going to be gaining on us. To get to writers, you often had to get to the executives they trusted. Marty Baum introduced me to Ted Ashley, the dashing ex-agent who'd become the chairman and CEO of Warner Brothers. Ted was the guy in our business. Early in my career, I'd visited his penthouse at the Sherry Netherland and marveled at a Rothko on the wall. Then he took me to La Côte Basque, where I watched in awe as he slid the maitre d' $100 bill. Now, a few years later, Ted had heard that I was one of the rising new breed, along with Barry Diller, David Geffen, Michael Eisner, and Terry Semel. So he put me together with John Calley, Warner's cultured, soft-spoken production head. John had an artist's eye and ear. Directors loved him, and he was especially tight with Sidney Pollack and Mike Nichols and Clint Eastwood. When I learned that John was a speed reader, I began shipping him 3 or 4 Mort Janklow specials per week. Most had no future on the screen, but John finished every one. I sent him piles of scripts, whatever I could lay my hands on. John appreciated the attention and guided his friend Bob Town, the community's most prestigious screenwriter, to CAA. It was one of the great favors of my life. Town, who wrote such legendary scripts as Shampoo and Chinatown, was friends with other A-listers like Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson. Having him as a client gave me instant credibility. Now I can make bold plans about whom to go after next. No good deed in Hollywood goes unpunished, A few years later, I met with Callahan Towne's deal for Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, a hot property. While his associates were based in Warner's administration building, John worked out of a bungalow nearby. He met me at his door in a cardigan and hush puppies and welcomed me inside. Logs crackled in the fireplace and Mozart wafted from the stereo. "John," I said, "I'm trying to make a deal for Bob, but Frank Wells, the studio's president, is killing me, and I can't get it done. I don't know what to do." We had asked for gross profit participation, but Wells was offering only net. Gross was our holy grail, because the box office receipts established how much the studio owed your client. Net was nearly worthless, as studios took so many deductions in their accounting that they somehow never showed any profits. As one of David Mamet's characters says in his play Speed the Plow, "Two things I've learned, 25 years in the entertainment industry. The first one is, there is no net." A beat later, he adds, "And I forget the second one." "That goddamn Wells," John exclaimed. "What an asshole. He's too tough on the artists we love and need. You walk over there. I'm going to call him right now." I said, "John, I can't thank you enough. This is unbelievable." "No, no, not at all." As I walked out, I passed John's open window. He was on the phone with his back to me. "Frank," I heard him say, "Ovitz is on his way over. Kill him." And then, in 1979, ahead of schedule, we got a star. Having grown to 15 agents, we needed more space. When a failed hedge fund decamped from a suite of furnished offices in Century City, I wangled a below-market sublease. In our new lobby one morning, I glanced at the tenant list and spotted an eye-catching name on the 18th floor. Gary Hendler was a tax lawyer who'd started a high-end firm with Art Armstrong, a top business attorney, along with Barry Hirsch, Jake Blum, and Tom Pollock. Gary was one of the premier entertainment lawyers, the people who structured and vetted artists' contracts. Gary's client list included Robert Redford, Sean Connery, Sidney Pollack, and Barbara Streisand, among others. After I pestered his receptionist, Gary agreed to meet me for dinner at Scandia, the top restaurant of its day. I'd befriended the maitre d', a gregarious little guy named Giuseppe Belisario, and ate there four times a week. CAA later financed Giuseppe when he opened Giuseppe's in West Hollywood. By the time I intercepted the check, Gary and I had established a rapport. He understood my ambitions, and I knew all about his passions. The next day, I sent him a barrel of Hershey's Chocolate Kisses. The day after that, a good bottle of wine. The day after that, a first edition volume on the law. We met several times for lunch until one morning he called and said, "I'd like you to meet with Sean Connery." It wasn't so much that I'd bowled over Gary with my qualities as that there was little downside for him to making the introduction. Sean's career was in a deep, dark hole. Sean was in London, and a lot rode on our first phone call. I wouldn't get a mulligan. Like most men my age, I had grown up idolizing Sean Connery and the relaxed violence of his take on James Bond. But it would be a mistake to gush. I had to diplomatically tell him he was screwing up. A dock worker before he got into his acting, Sean couldn't stand being idle and worked nonstop. Usually I liked that quality in a client, but Sean said yes to everything, and the script or the director or the co-stars were routinely beneath him. Often all three. It had happened with The Next Man, his most recent flop, and it was about to happen again with Meteor and Cuba. When Sean came on the line, I told him, "If you're going to build your brand, you can't take roles at random. You need to choose better projects." I told him he needed to have exposure to a range of possible scripts and to have them developed into packages with him as the star. I also said he needed to work with better directors and that we'd get him those introductions and those jobs. This became the pattern for how I'd sign a star. Start by politely criticizing his choices, tell him he needed to see and choose better material and better directors, promise him both. I made no promises that he'd work with specific talent, because the easiest way to lose a client is to make a promise you can't fulfill. The client always remembers. Sean didn't ask which of our directors and actors I thought he should be paired with, which was fortunate because we didn't represent anyone of his stature. If he had asked, I'd have said what I often said in those days, "The creative talent that's right for you." Sean was quiet at first, but he gradually warmed to my candor about his decision-making process. The following week, we bought a full-page ad in the trades, all in bright red. Creative Artists Agency, Inc. is proud to announce the exclusive worldwide representation of Sean Connery. I tore it out and mailed it to Lee Rosenberg, the agent who'd scoffed at the idea we'd ever sign a movie star. Lee later became my neighbor, and we got along well, but for years I sent him an ad each time we signed a star. The one I sent